From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, fermented foods, very nutritious, very magic.
So you just shred up your cabbage, basically. You add a certain amount of salt by weight, and you kind of scrunch it together, you let it sit together, and what the salt does is it draws the liquid out of the cabbage. That becomes the environment in which these lactobacilli, which exist on the surface of the cabbage already, can start to grow and proliferate.
Taking stock of biological diversity using DNA barcodes.
It's ridiculous when you think about it that you take a liter of water. How much life can there be in such a small volume of water? And it's literally hundreds or even thousands of different species that we find.
And a frightening vision of a warming planet, hothouse Earth.
We propose that there could be what we call a planetary threshold, which is once those dominoes start falling, you can't stop it. And that would equate to a threshold that would eventually take the Earth system onto that hothouse trajectory that we postulate in this paper.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Bacteria are Earth's most ancient creatures, and there are lots of them, with a total mass 1,000 times more than all humans combined. Those microbes make planet Earth go round. Some of them are dangerous pathogens, most of them aren't. Indeed, some bacteria are great kitchen companions. Anna Sigrether has been playing around with bacteria for years, fermenting food and drinks. How did you get interested in fermentation?
Oh, boy.
And I know you've been into it for years.
Yeah, for years. I mean, I think that originally, like many, many people who are kind of practicing fermentation in what I would call kind of this era of the fermentation revival of the last 15, 20 years or so, I came across the book Wild Fermentation by Sandor Katz, who is known by many to be kind of the godfather of the fermentation revival movement. And this book was kind of a cult hit. You know, it was quite published by a small publisher, and it was introducing this idea that you could do ferments at home just using kind of like the microbes that were present on surfaces. And you didn't have to buy a fancy culture. You didn't have to have any special lab equipment. And you could just kind of start engaging with the world of microbes that are already always present around you, and make these tasty and interesting and cultural foods, in both meanings of the term culture.
So you started experimenting.
Yeah, I did. And so this was probably, well, I don't know exactly the year that Wild Fermentation came out, but I probably came across it at least 10 years ago. And I was already a young kind of cook, self-taught cook, and very interested in food, and was already kind of running my own little catering business. So I just got curious about fermentation and started kind of incorporating it into my dishes.
Now, of course, bacteria engage in fermentation, but yeasts do as well. And you know, the yeasts, alcoholic fermentation, and the bacteria as well. I mean, the bacteria produce acids, and there are lots of different bacteria. Do you distinguish in your fermentation work between ferments that involve yeasts and those that involve bacteria?
I mean, obviously, like when you're making ferments, depending on which microbe you're working with or sets of microbes you're working with, you're going to have different processes. But I think that, it's an interesting question, like to distinguish kind of between the maybe like more scientific biological definition of fermentation versus the kind of more culturally situated sets of practices that we call fermentation, which are not necessarily all the biological definition. For instance, I work a lot with molds, and molds are not anaerobic, and so that's not the biological definition of fermentation. But culturally, they're still producing a microbially transformed food item, which I think within the sort of broader way of understanding fermentation today, we would call fermented. So to answer your question, I think like if I'm working with if I'm trying to make like a natural fermented beverage, like a natural wine or something out of a juice, I'll probably work with it in a similar way that I would work with something to create like a pickle. And those are two different microbes. The wine would be a yeast and the pickle would be a bacteria, but they both require an anaerobic environment. So a lot of the same principles apply. Whereas if I'm trying to make something like inoculated grain using the koji spores, then I would be treating that very differently because it's in an open air environment. You need to keep it warm. There's just a bunch of other kind of like hands-on practical environmental details.
But if I were to ask you what specific groups of bacteria are engaged in the fermentations or mediate the fermentations that you do, do you know which species or groups of bacteria these are?
I have some sense of an idea. I'm not a microbiologist, and I don't have access to like the equipment and tools to necessarily be like sampling my microbes and my ferments. But I generally know, you know, like if you're making anything that's like souring pickles or yogurt or things like that, you're using lactobacillus cultures. There's also other sets of bacteria that, you know, are at play in the primary colonization of things like sauerkraut. There's a bacteria called Leuconostoc that's, produces some of the savoriness that that's a hallmark of good sauerkraut, at least to my understanding. And so as you gain a little bit more of that kind of technical awareness from your own hands-on practice, and you start to learn and sort of synthesize with some more kind of theoretical knowledge about these bacteria, you can kind of start to like improve your fermentation practices by knowing, for instance, Leuconostoc prefers a cooler environment at the beginning of the ferment to take hold. So you want to keep your sauerkraut in a cooler place when it's first starting to ferment so that those bacteria can come in and generate some of the more like tasty flavors before the just lactobacillus just comes in and just, you know, rips that pH right down.
And you experiment. How do you figure out how to do a ferment? Like, you've been doing these for years. How do you go about doing a ferment? I mean, there are lots of different kinds of ferments. Where do you learn how to do this, and where do you get your bacterial cultures from?
Yeah, well,
maybe you want to talk specifically about a particular ferment that involves like sauerkraut, for example, and how you go about doing it, or any other ferment that interests you that involves bacteria.
Okay, so like, so bacteria specifically?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So I mean, sauerkraut's a great example because cabbage is a food that has bacteria already present on it. A lot of times, like if you look at a purple cabbage specifically, you've probably seen that kind of like white film that you can rub off with your finger on the surface of the cabbage leaves. And that's known to be kind of like a biofilm, basically, is what it's called. It's a assemblage of different kinds of microbes. And almost without a doubt, that contains some lactobacillus, which is the microbe that does the sort of main fermentation in sauerkraut. So it's already present on the food when you buy it. You know, it's good to be able to buy something that maybe isn't too sprayed with chemicals so that you don't have to wash it before you use it. So that's just a tip that I have for making ferments, especially like with cabbage. And what you do, all you need to do to create the environment for fermentation to take place, and by that I mean for it to sort of provide the controlled environment for the controlled decomposition, which really is what fermentation is you need to add a certain percentage of salt. So you cut up the cabbage to increase the surface area. Increasing the surface area obviously just creates more entry points for the bacteria to get into the substance. It also creates more exit points for the water to flow out of the cabbage as it's drawn out by the function of the salt. So you just shred up your cabbage, basically. You add a certain amount of salt by weight. Usually I do about 2.5% salt by weight. And you just let it, you kind of scrunch it together. You let it sit together. And what the salt does is it, as I said, it draws the liquid out of the cabbage, and it, in that, you know, cabbage, salty cabbage juice, that becomes the environment in which these lactobacilli which exist on the surface of the cabbage already, can start to grow and proliferate. Now, the question is always like, is this, how do you know this is safe? Are there other bacteria? Well, the thing about salt is that it kind of inhibits the growth of almost all other bacterial strains, especially the ones that are going to be pathogenic or hurt you.
Like botulism.
Yes, exactly. Botulism. So you're pretty much guaranteed, especially in the case of like, once you're getting into those percentages of salt by weight, there's, to my knowledge, and certainly to my, all of my years of experience, there's really nothing that can harm you that can survive in that concentration of salt. But Lactobacillus thrives in that condition, and it will just start going to work eating the carbohydrates in the cabbage and lowering the pH. And then when it lowers the pH, aka making it more acidic, what it's doing is that it's sort of enacting a preservation kind of state for the cabbage. A lower pH is also inhibiting of further microbial growth. So you're kind of like introducing this inhibition through the salt, and then the bacteria takes the second step, makes it more acidic, and then it's really kind of a preserved food at that point, as well as a probiotic food.
And do you do this in a jar that's been sterilized, or how do you prepare the jar?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely should work with always like clean hands, clean equipment. But the nice thing about fermenting, especially lacto-fermenting in this case, is that you don't have to be totally sterile. This isn't like canning where you have to be really careful about, making sure that everything's been boiled or like put in a pressure cooker. You can just use soap and water and let things air dry. And that's good enough because, as we said, like there's already bacteria that you're introducing through the cabbage or through the food, the vegetable that you're putting into the jar. And the salt is the thing that's kind of providing the main, it's the bouncer, let's say, to the party.
And when your sauerkraut is ready, are there still live bacteria in there?
Yes, of course. I mean, as long as you haven't pasteurized it by like heating it up and killing it, which, you know, some commercial sauerkrauts will have had that happen. But yeah, no, there will be bacteria in there. I don't know what the populations look like from at the end of the process versus like, you know, in the middle when it's really active and bubbling. But yeah, there will be living bacteria.
And it gets active and bubbling.
Yes, absolutely.
That must be amazing watching that.
Fermentation is such a sensory thing. It engages you. You get to see so much visual change. You get to see so much. You get to smell so much sort of olfactory change. You get to taste so much gustatory change. You know, fermentation really is a sensory process that shows you transformation on many levels.
And I've heard that everybody says, oh, it's great to eat fermented foods, you know, sauerkraut and, you know, yogurt and other kinds of fermented products. But the fermented products that you buy in the supermarket, I gather, they don't contain live populations of bacteria. They're somehow, I don't want to say inferior, but they're kind of a notch below the home ferments that haven't been pasteurized. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, like I don't have access to a microscope, so I can't necessarily verify whether or not there's like these living colonies of bacteria, but I think my understanding and the logic would go that something that's a raw ferment, something that hasn't been heat treated and pasteurized, is going to have some living bacterial culture remaining in it, and something that has been pasteurized will not. And, you know, if part of the goal in eating fermented foods is to introduce some live bacterial culture into our gut microbiome, that according to what I've read, you know, some live bacteria do make it through our stomach acid and into the gut, you know, to further colonize and strengthen the gut. So if that's part of your goal of eating the fermented food, then I think it is a good thing to try to eat the raw ferments rather than like something that has been fermented and then pasteurized. However, you know, if your goal in eating ferments is just the flavor, then maybe you do have some like health issues or something where you're concerned about consuming bacteria for any reason. Maybe you have immunocompromised in some way and you've received medical advice to stay away from eating cultured foods, then it's also fine just to eat a pasteurized ferment, I would say personally.
Tell me about another one of your ferments that you really enjoy. Maybe, a juice or a drink.
Sure, yeah.
That's kind of fun and wild and amusing to create and tastes great and is healthy.
Right. Well, a type of drink that I've made and I've learned sort of by following the work of this California-based wild crafter, wild forager. His name is Pascal Baudard. He does this really neat thing. And I think this is also a Korean recipe as well, like a Korean sort of fermentation tradition. So I want to, also cite that. But I did learn it from Pascal Baudard, which is to make a pine cone soda. So pine cones, green pine cones, not when they're like brown and all open and dry and crunchy, but in that state when they're still kind of closed up and green, in the springtime usually, they are coated with, similar to the cabbage that has a coating of biofilm on it. These green pine cones are coated with a biofilm that contains, among many other things, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is it's the yeast that ferments sugar into alcohol and makes a lot of our favorite drinks here on planet Earth. And so what you can do is you can take these green pine cones, you can submerge them into kind of like a sugar water solution. The sugar water will feed and activate the yeasts that are present on the green pine cones. You just kind of close them up into a jar. They start to bubble after a couple of days, usually super, super active, quite incredible. And you end up having this like really delicious fermented pine cone syrup that you can then use to sort of inoculate into other juices. If you want to make like a sparkling cider, sparkling juice, you can also just kind of like drink it on its own as a little aperitif. It's an incredible, incredible flavor.
So is there a philosophy for you behind fermentation?
Yes.
Do fermenters have a philosophy? Do they have an idea that animates them, that they're trying to advance and bring to fruition through fermentation? Or is it just fun and healthful?
I think it depends on who you're talking to, but I would say that like maybe among some of the more dedicated acolytes of this fermentation revival movement, and again, I have to sort of cite the work and influence of Sandor Katz in this. A lot of these sort of more vocal and more kind of, I almost want to say evangelizing, but maybe I should say like inoculating these kind of people who are carrying these ideas and spreading them forth about fermentation. There's a very strong kind of philosophical or like rhetorical political bent to it, which is that the fermentation itself is kind of a metaphor in their eyes for social change, for healthfulness, for kind of reintroducing ecological diversity, even at a micro scale, for kind of better relations between species. And so the fermentation as a practice becomes kind of like an index and a metaphor for these values. And of course, this is great, but these values are not necessarily inherent or essential to the act of fermentation, because fermentation is, as we're seeing, very much just capable of being industrialized and commodified, just like any other food process. So I think that, it's important when we think about the sort of transformative potential of fermentation and of microbes to not get too caught up in thinking that this is sort of, that these principles go wherever they go. We have to be conscious of the social contexts in which fermentation is practiced, just as much as fermentation itself.
Is fermentation fun? Is it amusing?
I think it can be. Yeah.
Does it strike you as mysterious that you never quite know how things are going to turn out?
The mysteriousness shifts locations, maybe. Like at first it seems very mysterious because you don't know what's going to happen at all. You're just sort of, it's an experiment. As you become more familiar with your ferments and with the bacteria that you work with, you become a little bit more literate of the whole process and the signs and the sort of like markers of a good ferment or of a bad ferment. And so the mystery maybe kind of goes a little deeper. But yeah, there's definitely always mystery there.
Can one ferment meat products that are fermented?
Absolutely. Yeah, meats are one of the biggest, you know, categories of fermented foods.
Can you give me an example of a meat ferment that you do?
Yeah, I've made, foods that, you know, in the Italian tradition we would call salumis, sort of a fermented, dry cured meat sausages, or things like prosciutto, which are, you know, a whole leg of pork that's sort of like dried and fermented. So I've made some salamis and things like that. They take a lot of specialized equipment. And there's a higher risk of foodborne illness with those. So I tend to sort of do those maybe a little bit like less often. But yeah, fermented meat is super common worldwide. If you have ever had salami, that's a fermented meat.
Huh. And do you experiment? Do you just try this and that and you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but you figure you'll give it a shot? Something you've never done before and you think, I wonder what that would taste like if I mixed it with that and put some water in and salt, and I wonder what will happen.
Yeah, and definitely I will do that with things like vegetable ferments, absolutely, because I feel comfortable understanding the sort of safety principles of it, so I can, as long as you know that you're keeping a certain salt percentage by weight, you're keeping things submerged in an anaerobic environment, you can just have at her. It's really fun, you know, to see what flavors come out the other side of the fermentation. Sometimes it's surprising, you know, you put something in that has one taste and the microbes and the interaction with the other ingredients completely transform the taste profile.
Huh. Sounds magical to me.
That really is like the funnest part of fermentation, is sort of seeing what comes out the other side. Honestly, you know, it's quite romantic. There's quite a kind of romance to it in the 19th century sense of the term, you know, the idea of the sublime nature, the something that's kind of at once beautiful and awe-inspiring. And so that's kind of like where my eyes are focused, or my senses are focused, is kind of like looking at these current cultural manifestations of our understandings of microbes and our understandings of our place amongst different species, microbial species and other species, and even each other. And I think fermentation, because it is just such a kind of like big cultural thing right now, it's a great sort of space through which to look at these things.
And there is a fermentation revival going on, you're saying?
Huge, huge revival. Yeah. And it's now past the state of being just a subcultural thing. It's, you know, the fermented foods industry is a growing multi-billion dollar a year industry. And so there's just, you know, all of the sort of consequences of that, you know, when things become industrialized as well and marketed and capitalized. And yeah.
So how do you explain this culturally and historically, that there is a revival for fermentation, that people are getting, it's more in the popular culture and people are talking about it, there's greater interest about it. You know, all the while traditional cultures have practiced fermentation forever.
Right, right. Yes. I mean, exactly. An important point that I missed there, which is throughout most of the 20th century, well, since germ theory was basically established and proven through the work of early microscopy and, you know, and the research of people like Louis Pasteur, we made some huge strides in understanding, you know, what was making people sick, the causes of disease and mortality. A lot of it was contamination and infection. So the technological and social advancements that we use to keep ourselves safer, you know, pasteurizing food, named after Pasteur, penicillin, you know, to protect, to uh, stop infections in the body, antibiotics. So we've sort of, we moved into this world that was a very kind of antiseptic world, very, very pasteurized and evacuated of microbial life. And for a long time, for, you know, most of the 20th century, that was just sort of the way things were. You know, everything was sterile and increasingly industrialized, increasingly homogenized, increasingly packaged.
And this fear that microbes is thought of, idea about microbes as being dangerous.
Yes. And, it, you know, that's because in a, some of them really are. And that was, you know, these advancements were really good at like saving lives in the sense of helping us remove those really dangerous ones. But what that did was that really threw the baby out with the bathwater, because a lot of microbes, as we know, are essential to our thriving in existence. So fermentation revival is just part of, you know, figuring out how to reintroduce those into our diets, and also sort of more broadly and conceptually make more room for them in our, in a more kind of nuanced understanding of like the microbial landscape around us, and like, which, you know, people talk about good and bad microbes, kind of trying to figure out what the good microbes are and how to foster them.
When Anna Sigrather isn't chopping up cabbage or pine cones, setting them up to ferment, she's studying fermentation culture at Concordia University in Montreal. Read more about kitchen countertop fermentation at greenplanetmonitor.net. Since the dawn of civilization, nothing has fascinated humans more than the diversity of life around them. Aristotle was among the first natural historians. Naturalis Historia by Pliny is the Roman Empire's largest surviving work. The collection, description, and preservation of living things has come a long way since then. Today, biologists use high-tech tools to collect creatures and DNA barcoding technology to identify them. Here's a story for you. I'm standing in a wooded park in the Dutch city of Leiden. Michael Steck, a researcher at the nearby Naturalis Biodiversity Center, is vacuuming the air with a handheld device called a pollen sniffer.
It's drawing in the air.
Steck studies simple plants called bryophytes, such as the mosses and liverworts. Today, he's prospecting for bryophyte spores. Anything else floating in the air will be sucked in too and get deposited on a sticky slide.
What you usually see are pollen grains and fungus spores. What I'm then interested is in fact how many spores, for example, of bryophytes are there at a certain moment.
The spores, plant hairs, and airborne microbes stuck to Michael Steck's pollen sniffer slide will get identified here at the Naturalis Center using DNA barcoding technology. Naturalis is home to one of the largest collections of animal, plant, and fungal specimens in the world, from all over the world. One of their big projects, Arise Biodiversity, aims to identify all forms of multicellular life in the Netherlands. 50,000 species is their target. They're up to 5,000. Dutch biologists and citizen scientists bring in specimens all the time.
Klaas brought us here three drawers of new specimens, the whole butterflies, Lepidoptera groups.
Hanko Bakker is in charge of receiving them.
And he brought us also a tray of bottles with caterpillars that we're going to try to get the DNA out of it. And I got two boxes here of genitalia preparates. These are sometimes necessary for identification of the species.
Klaas Kah specializes in butterflies and moths. And they're very tiny. These are
some are tiny, some are larger.
Klaas lives in the North Sea town of Den Helder, where Lepidoptera abound.
The other area where I often go is Den Helder. So I have about 800 species in total there over the last 30 years.
Klaas sits on the dunes at night in Den Helder, luring butterflies and moths into his traps with a bright light. He lets most of them go. The few he keeps will help researchers understand and conserve insect diversity. Catching caterpillars is easy.
You can find a lot of caterpillars using UV light at night, so they glow in the dark. And sometimes you can beat the bushes and then they fall out.
Do you see there being a reason for documenting the diversity? Why do it?
Well, if you don't know what's around, you don't know what to protect.
Yeah, partly it's an academic question to know what's out there. But we have to realize that we humans are part of this Earth, of this ecosystem. So we really need all other species on Earth.
We certainly need beetles. These are the insects Jan Wieringa collects for DNA barcoding and preservation here at Naturalis. Before they get shelved, Wieringa pins them up in public. It's the tiny beetles that amaze people the most.
Families with children come to my table and see that I'm mounting a beetle of only 2 millimeters. And they say, oh, that's a small thing, what is that? That's a beetle. But in their mind, beetles are always 2 or 3 centimeters because those are the beetles that they're seeing. They're only seeing the really huge longhorn beetles or big ones that are on flowers. That's what they know. They never really dig into their garden and see that within those leaves there are all kinds of much smaller insects crawling around. So I'm educating the public, and I hope that by seeing that there's so much more out there, especially small, and that they really have to start looking, that they'll start appreciating it more.
If we go to this one, we can go in here.
The most amazing creatures to behold here at Naturalis are the ones the public doesn't get to see. 20 floors of specimens in glass-topped boxes tucked into tall sliding shelves.
We have an estimation of currently 43 million specimens, but that's just an estimation because we didn't count every single insect.
In a nearby lab, a pair of students are prepping specimens to be barcoded. DNA barcodes are short sequences of the genetic alphabet unique to each living kingdom. Animals have one, plants another, fungi yet another. Within any of these broad groups, DNA barcodes vary from species to species. Here at Naturalis, barcodes are read using a device the size of a computer printer, then matched with known barcodes in the world's biggest databases. In addition to their own archived specimens, Naturalis barcodes environmental samples scientists and ordinary people bring in, fistfuls of soil, ghost nets pulled out of the North Sea, covered in life, vials of turbid water from a stream or lake. Kevin Bainchus leads the sequencing work.
I mean, it's ridiculous when you think about it that you take a liter of water. How much life can there be in such a small volume of water? And it's literally hundreds or even thousands of different species that we find.
In water that's essentially clear. I mean, you don't see fish, things
yeah.
swimming around in
yeah,
it, yet there's like 1,000 or more species of life in there.
Nah, you filter the water, and of course, when you examine the filter afterwards, it's a little brown, greenish color. But basically, we're looking at DNA traces that are left behind, and we're not catching any specimens. I mean, we're catching, of course, the microscopic life forms, but I'm not catching any fish. But we find several dozens of fish in just a liter of water. It's, marvelous.
Like supermarket barcodes in the commercial world, DNA barcodes enable natural resource managers to inventory, track, and conserve animals, plants, and other life forms in the ecosystems we humans inhabit.
We want to know all life on Earth, basically, at some point. And we don't know many of the organisms that are there. But it's also about what are the functions for the ecosystem, and also what are the functions, finally, for humans, for us.
Back in the park, Michael Steck has just switched off his pollen sniffer and is inspecting the sticky slide inside.
Let's see if we have caught something.
It's like fishing.
It is fishing in the air, yes. Oh, yes. You can even see it with the naked eye.
Steck takes a closer look with his hand lens.
Oh, that's interesting.
Among the bryophyte and fungal spores that fascinate Steck the most, detritus from the world humans have created.
Fibers in different colors, green and red, maybe microplastics.
It's a far cry from what Aristotle and Pliny observed thousands of years ago. The human detritus they came across, large and tiny, would have been local in origin. Today, human materials and chemicals swamp nature and endanger species. All the more reason to take stock of the living.
And also different pollen grains, bigger ones, the smaller ones.
Read more about DNA barcoding and the ARISE biodiversity project here in the Netherlands at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Earth's surface is a little over 1 degree warmer today on average than it was at the start of the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago. It doesn't seem like much. Under the Paris Agreement, governments agreed to limit temperature rise to 2 degrees. At present emission rates, that target will likely be exceeded. In a landmark report published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences back in 2018, researchers warned that a 2-degree rise in global surface temperature may actually exceed a critical planetary threshold, pushing Earth down a cascade of tipping points into hothouse mode, unlike anything this third rock from the sun has experienced since the mid-Miocene epoch 15 million years ago. I spoke with the lead author of that report, Will Steffen. You're associated with these ideas together with Johan Rockström of planetary boundaries and safe operating space, which is kind of apropos to our conversation right now.
Absolutely. Johan came up with the idea of planetary boundaries, and they are designed to say what is required to keep the Earth in a Holocene state, the Holocene being the last approximately 12,000-year geological epoch. It's the last interglacial in that series of glacial-interglacial cycling, and it's very important for humans because this, during the last 12 years, we've developed agriculture, settlements, more complex societies, etc. So the idea of the planetary boundaries was to explore, using the best science we could, how far can you push the Earth system and various important processes in the Earth system before you transgress Holocene bounds and move the system onto another state. This paper is a natural follow-on to the planetary boundaries in a way, saying we know that we're exceeding some of the planetary boundaries. We know we've actually left the Holocene. There's an enormous amount of evidence. We're in what Paul Crutzen has termed the Anthropocene. But the Earth system's not in a stable state now. It's in a highly transient state. And where might it go? So that was the motivation for bringing together 13 or 14 scholars from around the world who are all interested in and are experts in various aspects of this question. So that was really the motivation for the paper.
And that that other notion of safe operating space suggests that Earth is no longer, seemingly thanks largely to human beings, Earth is no longer at a steady state, and it may potentially no longer at some point, it may no longer be a safe operating space for human beings.
Yeah, in fact, one could make the argument because some of the planetary boundaries, the two really important ones, climate change and biosphere integrity, have already been transgressed. Biosphere integrity probably more seriously. You could argue that we're no longer really in a safe operating space, and we can already see that in a way. For example, with the increase in extreme weather events, heat waves, more intense tropical cyclones, bushfires, that sort of thing, it's telling us we're no longer really in a safe operating space. And of course, it's really the most vulnerable people around the planet who are already starting to feel the impacts of that. We're no longer in a safe operating space. We're in a transient phase. The Earth system is shifting. It's no longer in a stable state. And the question is, what trajectory might it take in the future, and what is the role of humans in that trajectory?
Well, let's get to that shortly. But in terms of this notion of possible sliding or slipping or sliding into hothouse earth. How hot could it get if things we slipped into that uncontrollable mode? How hot could planet Earth, surface of the Earth, get?
Well, we're suggesting 4 to 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, and that's based on paleoclimate analogs that if we go toward mid-Miocene conditions, which was about 15 million years ago, so it's not all that long ago, really, in Earth history, that's the last time we saw CO2 up between 400 to 500 parts per million, and the temperatures were 4 to 5 degrees higher, a big range of estimates of sea level rise, probably at least 10 meters higher than today, but it could go as high as 30 or 40 meters higher eventually. So we know that in the very recent past, the Earth is actually capable of being in such a state. So our analysis suggests that if we do cross what we're proposing as a planetary threshold and trigger a lot of feedbacks that put more carbon into the atmosphere, as well as decrease ice much more rapidly, and therefore increase the absorption of sunlight, you could very well get to mid-Miocene conditions. And we say it could be as fast as a century or two.
And that would be a global average. You speak about 4 to 5 degrees Celsius post-industrial. That would be a global average. You'd see exceedances, temperature rises way higher than that.
Yeah, in fact, we're already seeing that. You know, we had an excursion in the Arctic region of somewhere around 30 degrees Celsius above average for a couple of weeks, which is absolutely remarkable. But I think if you just look at average, the northern high latitudes, and of course this is very important for Canada, the northern high latitudes are warming at roughly twice the global rate. So if that ratio holds in the future, you could see temperatures 8 to 10 degrees higher than pre-industrial in the northern high latitudes.
What is a positive feedback, and can you describe some of these sorts of positive feedbacks that happen?
Yeah, positive is probably not a good word for the general public. It's one we use in science. Positive means reinforcing. It means it reinforces the driving force that triggered the feedback in the first place. So basically in our paper, we look at two types of these feedbacks, carbon cycle feedbacks and ice albedo feedbacks. But a good example of a carbon cycle feedback is, in fact, what we've just been talking about, the vast boreal northern forests. And they store a lot of carbon, and they could act as a carbon sink if they are healthy and maintained in a viable state. But as they are increasingly at risk of burning, which we've talked about, but also insect infestation, the spruce bark beetle is a classic case there. It's affected a lot of forests in British Columbia, for example. What's happening is as these forests are weakened by insect attacks and then burn, they are releasing carbon back to the atmosphere. Interestingly, the best data we have actually comes from Canada. It comes from the Canadian Forest Service. And they've been doing very meticulous surveys of the carbon dynamics of those forests over a century. And what they find is that indeed, up until around 1970 or so, the Canadian boreal forests were actually removing carbon from the atmosphere in a net sense. But as the temperature has warmed, you get more fires, more insects, and these forests are now at best carbon neutral, and in bad years, they're actually a net emitter of carbon to the atmosphere. So this is a positive feedback. The Earth warms, it makes Canadian boreal forests more vulnerable, they burn, they emit carbon to the atmosphere, and it warms it even more.
And then the reduction of Earth's albedo, talk about that.
Yeah, well, that happens as ice sheets shrink. Again, the most vulnerable one is the Arctic sea ice, summer sea ice. So this is the ice that floats over the Arctic Ocean during summertime. Normally it would be a few meters thick. It's not only been thinning out, it's also been decreasing in area. So when it decreases in area in the summertime, of course that's when the sun is over the far north, instead of reflecting sunlight, it's absorbing. The darker ocean water absorbs sunlight. And this leads to further regional warming. And of course, as it warms further, the ice shrinks further back, which uncovers even more water. It warms even more, and so on. This is another example of a feedback loop. So we're talking about two types of positive feedback loops, one involving the carbon cycle the other involving ice albedo effect.
And then you conjure up the notion of tipping points that, you know, as Earth's system warms, accelerated by positive feedbacks of various types, we theoretically approach a tipping point where suddenly things go completely nonlinear, and there might even be a sequence of tipping points. Can you figure three in your article for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences kind of suggests that there might be three tiers of tipping points. The first between 1 to 3 degrees warming, and then between 3 to 5 degrees warming, and then another tipping point when we suddenly exceed 5 degrees. Can you talk to me about that?
Well, really what we're talking about, yes, in our figure three is a cascade of these, like a row of dominoes. And you start tipping the first dominoes, and they tip the next one, which tips the next one, and so on. And people are familiar, I think, with that analogy. But if you like, our tipping elements, which sit in the 1 to 3 degree category, are the dominoes at the front of the line of dominoes. And then the ones 3 to 5 are in the middle, and the ones 5 are at the end. So the idea is...
And go through those. What are the first ones? What are the second ones? What are the third ones?
Yeah, well, we've talked about one of the first ones, and that's the Arctic summer sea ice. We also think, by the way, up in the far north, the Greenland ice sheet might be vulnerable somewhere around 2 to 3 degrees. Coral reefs, which actually don't act too much as a domino, we think they're really vulnerable at 1.5. We'll lose... most of them, the West Antarctic ice sheet, alpine glaciers. So there's a lot of vulnerable ice here that is thought to be have tipping points 1 to 3 degrees. And most of those are sort of in the polar areas, but they're going to unleash stronger regional warming. And if the warming then goes up toward 3 degrees, we have a whole set of tipping points which may be further vulnerable. One of them, we talked about the boreal forests, and we know that they're already showing signs of vulnerability a bit over 1 degree. So that may be an underestimate. We may see action at 2 degrees on the boreal forest. Nevertheless, they're put in the 3 to 5 at the moment. The Indian summer monsoon season, the North Atlantic circulation system, the Amazon forest, are all in that category. Now, of course, the Amazon forest would release an enormous amount of carbon to the atmosphere as well. Then if you get those going, then you go back to the poles, and there's some more recalcitrant ice that could be vulnerable at 5 degrees. And that's the permafrost, which would release carbon. That's mainly in eastern Siberia. Ocean methane hydrates, that's methane stored in ocean sediments. And even the East Antarctic ice sheet, which is the big one. I mean, that's the big, very stable one. At 5 degrees, we're worried that could be unstable. So it acts like a wave of tipping elements that start at the poles, go down toward the mid-latitudes and equator, and then come back to the poles. So it's like a stack of a weaving stack of dominoes that once you start tipping them, the whole thing may go. So when you put that whole story together, we propose that there could be what we call a planetary threshold, which is once those dominoes start falling, you can't stop it. And that would equate to a threshold that would eventually take the Earth system onto that hothouse trajectory that we postulate in this paper.
And that could be like at 2 degrees Celsius. Here we're talking about trying to achieve the Paris target of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, and everybody thinks of that as being kind of the conservative approach, but we don't know whether or not at 2 degrees Celsius we might set the dominoes falling, and then even reductions would be for naught.
That's exactly right. Our best estimate is that we're still pretty safe at 1.5, the lower the Paris targets. You'll get perhaps some of the tipping elements like coral reefs will go, but we don't think the domino effect is very likely at 1.5. At 2 degrees, it's more possible. It's hard to put a number on that probability until we do more research. So at the moment, really what we're putting forward here is a risk analysis. But what we're saying is as you go beyond the Paris targets toward 3 degrees, the risk rises quite sharply. It's a nonlinear function. So that there's a real risk at 3 degrees, we think, that you're going to hit that domino effect and push the system out of our control. So when you work backwards then, when you look at the pledges that countries have made in response to the Paris targets, that would take the Earth to about 3 degrees. So right now the stated level of ambition around the world is far, far too weak to keep this risk at a low level.
And this one of the scary amongst various scary ideas that you present in your paper is this idea that we may have unbeknownst to us actually passed a fork in the road. Like here we're walking along a road and there are various forks in the road leading to this runaway process, and we may have already passed one of the forks in the road.
Well, we actually say we have passed one fork in the road, and that fork in the road is the idea that if we could somehow take the pressure off, the Earth would go back down to the Holocene state, the period of the last 12,000 years. It won't. And there's good analyses already that we've already knocked the next glacial state out. In other words, about every 100,000 years, you go through one of these cycles of a long glacial and a short interglacial. Well, we've missed the next glacial already, so we've crossed one fork of the road. And of course, some people argue, well, we wouldn't want to go into a glacial state anyway. And that may be true, but as Paul Crutzen said way back in the year 2000, if we were really smart, we would inject just the right amount of designer greenhouse gases to keep the Holocene state going. And of course, we're not doing that. We're massively overloading the system with greenhouse gases. So that fork in the road we talk about in the paper is the fact we've left the Holocene, we're in the Anthropocene. And we also make a really important point is that this 1.5 to 2 degree world, the Paris target world, is not an intrinsically stable state of the Earth system. It has to be managed and maintained through human stewardship, ongoing stewardship. So I think that's a very important point that people need to make, is we are already committed to being stewards of the Earth system. The question is, are we going to be good stewards, effective stewards, or is the system going to get out of control?
And there we confront something you refer to called a technological lock, that we, you know, it's great notion that we should be good stewards. Let's start being good stewards, but we're kind of locked in technologically and in the grip of socioeconomic inertia.
Yeah, I mean, those are huge issues. And I'll have to say, although we flag a lot of those issues, because of the constraints of the paper and the fact that we wanted to get the geophysical Earth system story really clearly out there, we don't go into enough detail on exactly the issues that you're raising. And that needs to be urgently addressed by experts in socioeconomics, technology, political science, ethics, values. You know, so we need historians, we need philosophers, and so on, ethicists, to really, really take a really hard look at contemporary human societies and say what needs to be changed so that we do become effective stewards of the planetary system.
I mean, can we turn things around while at the same time embracing this notion of permanent growth?
Well, certainly I don't think so. Not material growth, and of course that's what we're seeing is that not only are we putting an enormous amount of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, when you look at the other parts of the Earth, we're putting enormous amounts of plastics into the ocean. We're spreading the Earth's surface in concrete. There are all sorts of indicators that people who are studying the Anthropocene from a geological stratigraphic point of view are saying this is really astounding. What's happening to planet Earth. So yes, I think it's pretty clear that we cannot go on with business as usual or minor modifications of business as usual. We need a pretty comprehensive overhaul of what I might call a human enterprise.
Will Steffen was an eminent Earth system scientist, a native of Norfolk, Nebraska. Steffen emigrated to Australia in the 1970s, where he took up a position at the Australian National University in Canberra. Steffen served as the executive director of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, a groundbreaking initiative aimed at studying the chemical, physical, and biological processes governing Earth as a system. His name came to be associated with a host of ideas about our planet and humanity's fate on it: planetary boundaries, safe operating space. Steffen's great acceleration curves helped corroborate the idea, first proposed by Paul Crutzen, that Earth has entered a new epoch, the Anthropocene. Will Steffen passed away in January 2023, we'll post a link to a commemoration of Will Steffen's life and scientific accomplishments at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions, Breda in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. And please subscribe. A pop-up box will be popping up real soon. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now. Thank you.